Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, June 18th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. On today's program, we're going to have a special guest who's been on this program many times before, a very prominent figure in Europe and a current candidate for president of France, Jacques Cheminade. So I'll be joined by Jacques in a moment. But I want to start with a special update from Jeff Steinberg, who I've asked to pull over on the side of the road so he could give us this report. We've had some extraordinary changes in the last days, and it goes back to the longer-term fight for by Lyndon LaRouche for a return to Glass-Steagall, and that this has been, from the beginning for LaRouche, connected to the status of President Barack Obama. Because we know that Obama stopped the Glass-Steagall that was proposed by Senators Maria Cantwell and John McCain from being included in the Dodd-Frank bill. In fact, that is the only thing that would have allowed the Dodd-Frank bill to be a useful bill. Otherwise, it's a piece of garbage. But LaRouche said as long as Obama remains in the White House, the prospects for Glass-Steagall were nil because he would stop it. Now, in the last 48 hours, though, we've seen a significant change that goes back several weeks to the arrest in New York City of the International Monetary Fund chief, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. And I've asked Jeff to come on to get us up to date on this incredible strategic shift underway, which means that the potential for Glass-Steagall and the potential for removal of Obama have both been increased dramatically. So, Jeff, why don't you give us a report?
Okay, thanks a lot, Harley. Well, look, I think you touched upon some of the most critical watermarks of this period. There was the incident now about a month ago where Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, was arrested and detained in New York City on basically rape charges. And as the result of that incident, he's been forced to resign as managing director of the IMF. We know at the very moment that he was arrested, he was on board a plane bound for Europe where he was putting the final elements together of what would have been a disastrous second round of hyperinflationary bailout of the transatlantic system. He had the backing of Geithner and Bernanke. So there would have been a hidden U.S. further bailout component. And, of course, as managing director of the IMF, he had the funds available from the IMF countries outside of Europe to contribute about 40% of the bailout, countries like Saudi Arabia, China, Japan. And so the arrest of Strauss-Kahn was a strategic move, and the intent of that move was to say no more bailouts. And by taking out the key player who was putting together a hyperinflationary bailout package, they basically took that option off of the table. And since that point, what we've seen in Europe has been the accelerated disintegration of the entire euro system. People have been closely following events in Greece, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. The collapse of Greece and its likely departure from the euro system will mean that the whole Maastricht-Lisbon Treaty structure is doomed and one way or the other will disintegrate. The impact of the Europe developments on the United States are that you're going to see an acceleration towards another major Wall Street blowout. Neil Barofsky, who was the Special Inspector General of the TARP bailout program of 2008 onward, wrote in a recent article interview that the next round of bailouts of Wall Street, of the too big to fail banks, will cost taxpayers another $5 trillion. What this all means is that the entire transatlantic financial and monetary system as currently constituted, is absolutely doomed to an early death. We can't forecast precisely when it's going to happen, but we know it's something that is moving very rapidly towards a breakpoint.
And Jeff, because of developments in Greece and the reports in the United States of the housing crisis deepening, unemployment deepening, this is now not just confined to the business pages, but it's becoming increasingly evident to even the man in the street.
Absolutely right. And so what you've got now is a situation where the current system is doomed, and there are two or three different ways that the demise could happen, but it is moving in a very rapid direction, and therefore, the only legitimate alternative to this, which is the immediate passage of Glass-Steagall, is gaining significant traction. In the House of Representatives, we're now up to, I believe, 16 sponsors on H.R. 1489, the Return to Prudent Banking Act of 2011, introduced by Marcy Kaptur, with a bipartisan array of members of the House supporting it. I'm not at liberty to give names out, but I can tell you, have firm promises from at least another dozen members of Congress that they are in the process of also coming on board as co-sponsors. Now, what we have known and what Linda LaRouche has been emphasizing going all the way back to his April 11th, 2009 webcast, where he warned that Obama is not only a British agent, but is a seriously deranged narcissist of the type of Emperor Nero, and that Obama's removal from office is another precondition, along with the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, for saving the United States from sudden doom. Now, for a long time, people have been, even among the leading supporters of Glass-Steagall, have been attempting to dodge the bullet on the Obama question. That has now shifted, and has shifted decisively just in the past 5 days. There are many things that Obama has done that have led us to this point, but the Obama policy on Libya of engaging in war without going to the Congress to seek congressional support through Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution and through the War Powers Act, this has created now a constitutional crisis where a large number of lawmakers have come to the conclusion that the president is now in violation of the Constitution and has committed an impeachable offense by refusing to go to the Congress and get congressional authorization to go to war. The Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 says very clearly that only the Congress has the authority to declare war. The War Powers Resolution gave the president 60 days to conduct emergency military operations before he had to get the full approval of the Congress. We are now, as of tomorrow, on day 90 of the U.S. military engagement in Libya, and the president has refused so far to follow his constitutional responsibility. This is now a crime that fits the high crime and misdemeanor standard for the impeachment of the president. He has committed a clearly impeachable crime, and a bipartisan group of legislators is now moving to force that issue. Now, this is a shift in dynamic. This is not to say that there are going to be articles of impeachment brought up and voted on in the House next week or anything like that. But the issue has now been broached. The issue of impeachable crimes, the issue of Obama committing impeachable crimes, is now out there. What we had at the beginning of this week was a vote on an amendment to an appropriation bill that was introduced by California Democrat Brad Sherman, basically cutting off all further funding for the Libya operation. And that passed, that amendment passed by a wide bipartisan majority.
Jeff, I think that really was a real turning point, because Sherman had introduced it a few days before and lost. And then the second time it was introduced, it passed. And as you pointed out, it included Democrats and Republicans.
You had 60% of the Democrats in the House and 60% of the Republicans voting in favor of Sherman's resolution. Then, several days later, a group of 10 members of the House, 3 Democrats and 7 Republicans, filed suit in federal court in Washington, D.C., against Obama, and charged that he had violated the Constitution and the War Powers Act. Now, the president and his advisors at the White House, in their arrogance, thought that they could bully their way through, and they had put up Senators John McCain and John Kerry to issue a non-binding resolution that would have been used as the pretext by the president to avoid adhering to the Constitution and the War Powers Act. However, before that resolution could be introduced, Senator Richard Lugar, the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Relations Committee, published a scholarly article, an op-ed in the Washington Post, on June 5th, in which he directly cited the Constitution and said that the president was in absolute violation of the Constitution and that this was intolerable. In response to that, McCain and Kerry dropped the resolution. And so with the lawsuit, with the Lugar article, with the actions on the Brad Sherman amendment, we now have a situation comparable to the early moments of the Watergate crisis that brought down Richard Nixon.
And Jeff, I know you have to go, but I wanted to ask one other question that I think pulls this together. It's not just a coincidence that 4 of the initiators of the suit against Obama are also sponsors of the Glass-Steagall.
That's absolutely correct. It's John Conyers, Walter Jones, Roscoe Bartlett, and Dennis Kucinich. Kucinich is one of the more recent signatories on H.R. 1489. Yes, that's true. And I think that it should be seen in two different ways. Number one, obviously, that these people understand that Obama's actions on a wide range of issues, from the Libya violation of the Constitution to his staunch opposition to Glass-Steagall, which is destroying the U.S. economy, they see this as part and parcel of the same picture. The other aspect of it is that from the standpoint of what Lyndon LaRouche has been uniquely saying since the very outset of the Obama presidency, LaRouche has said what? He said, we must have Glass-Steagall as the first step towards saving the states, towards launching an economic recovery based on large-scale infrastructure projects like NAWAPA. And that, at the same time, we know that Obama, as both a narcissist and as a British stooge, is not going to go along with Glass-Steagall. If a clean Glass-Steagall bill were placed on his desk this morning, he would have had a mental breakdown, because he knows that his controllers in London and on Wall Street will absolutely forbid him from signing it. Remember, back a year ago, the British government delivered a warning to the Obama administration that passage of Glass-Steagall would be considered an act of aggression against Britain because of the offshore financial empire at the heart of the British Empire. So we are at a moment where both the prospects of passage of Glass-Steagall and the prospects of Obama's removal from office are both moving forward in a way that no one just a few weeks or months ago would have forecasted. The whole trend line that Lyndon LaRouche has polemicized against has been shattered, and there is a profound shift in direction. There's no guarantee of what the absolute outcome of this will be, but what's noteworthy is the shift in direction and the fact that there is now momentum on both the removal of Obama from office and even more so momentum building very rapidly for the passage of Glass-Steagall. And of course, if a bill is put on Obama's desk, that alone will be the end of the Obama presidency, because he will have failed to meet the most fundamental demands that were placed on him by London and Wall Street when they helped put him in office.
Well,
so
Jeff,
that's the picture.
There is one guarantee, which is that if you, the listeners, want to keep being updated on this, you can go to LaRouche Pack, and Jeff has been giving recently a series of updates on this fight, and I assume we'll see more of you on the LaRouche Pack website, Jeff. So thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Okay, my pleasure, and best regards to Jacques and to you, Harley, also.
Okay, Jeff, thank you.
Bye-bye.
So that was Jeff Steinberg, who's the counterintelligence director, one of the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review, and one of the leading activists involved in shaping the battle in Washington, D.C. Now we're going to be joined by Jacques Cheminade. Many of you have heard him before on this program. Jacques is a candidate for president of France, where there will be elections next year. Jacques' role in France is a very prominent one, often behind the scenes, but increasingly in public, as he was at the center of a very nasty, dirty tricks operation some years ago, which is getting a lot of attention. And Jacques, we may talk about that a little bit later in the program, but let me welcome you to the LaRouche Show.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Jacques, what I'd like to start with, because you and I have discussed this quite a bit, and I had a chance when I visited you in France to meet with a number of people who initially were great supporters of Obama. They welcomed him with open arms after the Bush period. A year later, there were questions being raised, shrugs, and so on. How do the French view Obama? You just heard Jeff's report on the constitutional crisis. What is the view of President Obama today among the French political people who are involved politically and economically?
Well, they tend to be very scared by the situation, and in particular by the situation in Europe. So therefore, they cling to their old constructs, to their old mythologies, I would say. So they pretend that Obama is still popular, and they pretend that they still believe in him, in a kind of reverse racism, saying that he is black, therefore he has to be good, and they play according to the old game. Now, if you explain the Obama sellout, what he really did, and his betrayal of his voters, and his betrayal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and if you explain what Lyndon LaRouche is doing, then people turn court very fast, because in fact, they try to believe that Obama could be good, but in fact, they don't believe it at all. So if you get to the surface, the true feelings, then you have a reaction against what's coming from the United States, even in political circles that pretend to be pro-American.
Well, for most of the part in the last 30 years, the role of the United States president in the G8 or the G20 in the transatlantic alliance, the U.S. president was generally deferred to as the most important figure. Has there been a shift in that, and the role that Obama has been playing, just to support the status quo, which is falling apart, has that had an effect on how he's viewed?
He's viewed as unable to handle the international situation, and more, the domestic disintegration of the United States is known in Europe. There are more and more articles on the bankruptcy of the American states. There are more and more articles on the horror show Schwarzenegger in California. There are more and more articles on Glass-Steagall. And we are doing our best to make it known that at the same time that you have in the United States this reaction of Congress, of the House of Representatives, against Obama on the Libyan question, that there is at the same time the development of the base for Glass-Steagall. And in France, people are expecting something to happen in the American Senate on Glass-Steagall after the initiative of Marcy Kaptur in the House of Representatives.
Well, let me ask you on this Libya question, because as Jeff pointed out, the current constitutional crisis that could lead to the ouster of Obama is based on his role in the U.S. playing an active role in the attacks on the government of Gaddafi in Libya. What is your view from France as to what's happening in Libya, and you know, is this just another quagmire, another one of these dirty little colonial wars?
Well, if you look at it the way it happened, Sarkozy ran his military operation with not even a discussion in Parliament. There was no discussion in Parliament, and he said that it was an operation in defense of a civilian population and not an act of war. So, of course, nobody believes him at this point. And what we have is an imperial presidency who had exposed itself, but an imperial presidency which tries to fart higher than its ass, as they say in France. So this means that now British and French armies suffer from a lack of ammunition, a lack of manpower, a lack of everything. So the French military are saying, we can only make it until Christmas. After, we won't be unable to sustain our effort. So you have the conjugation of a military bankruptcy with a financial disintegration in Europe. And in that situation, either Sarkozy goes there, which means that he sent troops, or he sent, there are already French agents in Libya, about 150, but he has to send more to do something before Christmas. So if he does that, it's a trap, it's a disaster. Or he has to decide not to go, but then he becomes a laughing stock. So either way, he's a loser. And that's the situation we have here. It's like a mirror of what's happening with Obama in the United States.
And I think just to ask one more point that we were discussing before the program, there's been a lot of coverage in the United States of what they call the Arab Spring that began with Tunisia and Egypt. And on the one hand, the trigger for it may have been the speculation in food prices, the hyperinflation, combined with the lack of jobs because of the economic collapse in these countries in North Africa and the Middle East. But then also there seemed to be a potential for a democratic change. And now we see some things that sort of a, well, it's not exactly what we're being told. You were saying some very interesting things about Tunisia. What is the situation there right now?
There's a lot of confusion. For example, they let a lot of hope from the people that have been freed from a dictature. But at the same time, they have lost all the tourist income. Western tourists are not going to Tunisia. And also, there is a lot of insecurity in the streets because people are so poor, and the police was all the police of the dictator, and now there is no more police. Even there are provocateurs which try to promote insecurity. So the situation is such that without our help from the United States and from Europe, Tunisia cannot make it and Egypt cannot make it. So we have to help them with Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall means that we can not only have a key to change from a higher form of economy, but it means also a platform of development of which Tunisia and Egypt would benefit. If not, today, with the rise of food prices, and that's the other point, with the rise of food prices, these people are starving or suffering serious malnutrition. So we have to freeze food prices at the same time that we launch the Glass-Steagall initiative. And this, without these two things, from there, they would not be able to make it. We have to give to them support, and there were a lot of nice sentences, there were a lot of nice speeches, good works, but nothing concrete was done for them. So these people need to be helped, and it's our duty, it's our mission to help them.
Now, Jacques, as you can see, most of what we're talking about comes back to the global economic crisis, or we could say the accelerating disintegration. There's a lot of attention now on what's happening in Greece and whether there will be a default, a haircut. There are a lot of euphemisms, but what we're really looking at is a bankruptcy of a whole system. Now, you and Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche were two of the most outspoken people against the euro and the European Union as it was initiated by Thatcher, Mitterrand, and to some extent George H.W. Bush. But why don't you just give us what you said at the time when the euro system was set up as to how you knew that this would eventually fail? What was the problem, the essential problem with what we're seeing breaking down now in Europe?
It's a system, idiot. With a bailout, you blow out the system, and without the bailout, the whole system collapses. So within the system, everything is finished. It's an endgame. The main point here is that the European Central Bank is in potential bankruptcy. The equity of the bank, it's more or less 5.3 billion euros. And the European Central Bank is exposed to 90 billion euros to Greece, to various Greek toxic assets that it swallowed, and beyond to about 2,000 billion of diverse forms of toxic assets from the 17 members of the European Union. So the European Central Bank is in potential bankruptcy. And in that situation, Greece, Portugal, and Ireland are really on the verge of exploding. The Greek interest rates, the 10-year Greek interest rates, have went beyond 18%. Now it's in Ireland 11.43% and 10.80% in Portugal. So it's absolutely impossible with that to have a management of these countries. So they are saying bailout, bailout, bailout. But what would mean a bailout? It would mean to gather at least first 100 billion for Greece. So the Germans don't want to pay, and the French don't want the French banks to pay. So the IMF hesitates and wants more austerity. So everybody agrees that there should be more austerity, and they are destroying Greece. Nonetheless, there is this debate between the French, the European Central Bank on one side, and the Germans on another side. The French said only act on the basis to involve the banks. Only have the banks take the same bonds of Greece than they manage to sell or to that come to end at this point. And the Germans are saying have a prolongation of the duration of the bonds of 7 years. But all that is nonsensical, because either way, it's a total disaster. Greece is destroyed. They are telling the Greeks, sell your airports, sell your ports, sell your islands, decrease even more the wages, destroy the pensions. It's something unbelievable, and you have at this point a true mass strike ferment in Greece against that. What's behind it? It's the fact that if it's agreed that it needs an haircut, a restructuration, then the credit default swaps taken on the Greek debt would have to be paid,
right,
because it would be a default, by the French and German banks. But this would not stop to Greece. It would spread into Ireland and Portugal first, and then probably in a few days or weeks into Spain. So the French banks, the so-called French, they are no more French banks, they are kind of this conglomerate around the city of London and Wall Street. The French banks, the German banks, the British banks, all would have to pay, and then all hell will break loose. It will be a general bankruptcy of the system.
Well, this
that's
is
why
what...
they are saying no, 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 and the French head of the governor of the Bank of France has said this is a scenario of horror, and Mario Draghi, who has organized all this embezzlement of Greece, he's saying now we are against the implication of creditors, of private creditors, only they should only be implied if it's willfully. So they cannot be implied against their will. So this is insane, because you are a situation where things is exploding and nobody wants to do nothing because everybody is afraid that the explosion would spread. And at this point, Moody's has downgraded the French banks. So this creates a lot of hysteria here. The French banks have been downgraded. Three of them have been downgraded, which is BNP, Paribas, the Société Générale, and the Crédit Agricole. So they have not been really downgraded, but they have been exposed as to a potential downgrading. So this has created a lot of reactions in the country, because at the last 3 months of last year, the French banks were exposed to the Greek debt for about $56.7 billion, according to the reports from the Bank of International Settlements. So there you have it. And the whole thing is connected. For example, you have this failure of Banco Santander. Banco Santander was unable to put on the market $1 billion in diverse assets that it has against regions of Spain and saving and loans banks in Spain. So they are saying this is a problem of Santander and this is a problem of the regional banks in Spain, but it's not true. In fact, the Spanish state is guaranteeing all these regions of Spain and also the saving and loans who are bankrupt, the cajas. So you have a potential bankruptcy spreading at any moment in Spain. At the same time, Standard & Poor's has downgraded four Italian banks, and Moody's has threatened to lower the rating of 14 British banks, and at this point, that's why the British are making promoting this kind of fake Glass-Steagall.
Right.
It's not a sign of power; it's a sign of weakness.
Now, you're listening to Jacques Cheminade, and this is the LaRouche Show for June 18th, 2011. Now, Jacques, what you just described is what Trichet and others are warning about. They call it a credit event. We don't want to unleash a credit event.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think this is very important, because some people say, well, so if Greece defaults on $10 billion in bonds, what's the big deal? There's all these bonds out there. Some investors will lose a little bit.
No.
What they don't realize is that what was done to create this giant Ponzi scheme was credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations, so that when these start unwinding, you're not talking about $10 billion, you're talking about trillions of dollars.
Trillions.
Up to 600 to 700 trillion is the latest figure on these CDOs and CDSs. And there's no way this would be a tsunami of unbelievable proportions. It wouldn't leave a bank standing in the world.
Well, it's what described now in France by some as the interconnection of the four main international markets. 600,000 billion of in what you described, the derivatives market, or the
right.
This main market in the planet. Mm-hmm. And 90% of all the transactions are on dark pools. So nobody knows exactly what it is. So at any moment, it can explode. The second market is the bonds. So 99% of the transactions are in the dark at this point with the bond markets. Nobody even knows what it is. Then they have the foreign trade markets, $4,000 billion every day. So in 15 days is the whole gross national product of the whole world. And it's 100% on the dark pools. And you have also the stock, which is less, and the raw materials, which is less, but it's also enormous, and with a rate of exposure that are unbelievable. So at this point, anything can happen. And if you look also at the United States, what you can see is that the American bonds sell for less than 3%, but the rest of inflation is about 5%, the real
rate
of inflation.
And Jacques, it's actually worse than that, because much of the hyperinflationary potential exists in the money that's currently being held by the banks and by the corporations.
This is
why we've had an inflation in commodities and also the stock market, and that's starting to fall. The stock market is starting to fall in the United States.
But in fact, the rate of American Treasury bonds is negative, 2 or 3%. And at the same time, what you have, which is the other thing that people don't want to say, but it's known by everybody, and in fact it's a secret which is not a secret, a secret polichinelle, as they say in France, is that more or less you have amounts that are many, many times the gross national product, 10, 20, 40 times the gross national product of all countries in the world. So at this point, when in some place something would happen, the whole thing would follow. That's
now
what they call the credit event, which is a global bankruptcy. That's a true word.
Now, I want to take up two other things before we run out of time, one of which is the incredibly insane decision by the Merkel government on nuclear power. But before we come to that, just to finish this picture on the economy, there are many people who are saying that there's probably more debt in France than is known, that the economic situation there, which appears from the outside to be relatively stable, is not. What is the picture inside France in terms of the economy? And then also, what do the French think in general about the euro? Because there's talk about not just defaults from countries like Greece, but perhaps exit from the euro by Greece. This could trigger also Portugal, Ireland. The Germans may decide no more bailout, they're going to leave. Is there a sense in France that the future of the euro is not good? And what is the actual situation with the economy in France?
Sarkozy said we should save the Europe at any cost. So that's Sarkozy's position. In the country, there are more and more people who think like me that we don't even need to attack the euro. The euro is committing harakiri and it's self-destroying. So at this point, the true question is Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall, Glass-Steagall. And France had a kind of Glass-Steagall after World War II. And it lasted, it was like in the U.S., it was destroyed little by little. But it lasted until 1984, where Jacques Delors put an end to this separation of, on one side, commercial and what they call in France, deposit and credit banks, commercial banks, and on the other side, business banks, what they call in French business banks, were investment banks. So there was a separation in France. And it's Jacques Delors who created these universal banks. So these universal banks are absolutely contaminated. At this point, Banque Nationale de Paris, Banque Nationale Paribas, the Pebro Bank, owns more or less a 3 of capital equity for 100 in assets. They have a 3%, which is the same rate as the American banks just before Lehman Brothers.
Right.
They are in the same situation in France. In fact, the situation appears to be better only because they consider that the sovereign risk, the risk against Greece, Ireland, or Portugal, is equal to zero because states never go bankrupt. So everybody knows that all the states are going to go bankrupt. So there is a kind of Potemkin disguise of things. Potemkin was his advisor, prime minister.
Oh,
of
Potemkin lives in Potemkin Village.
Potemkin Village of Queen Catherine of Russia. And when Catherine of Russia was visiting the villages, she was painted pieces of wood to appear as houses, and everything was going well. Now it's the same with the situation of the French banks. It's a situation which, on the books, appear to be good. But if you look what's inside the books, it's disaster. They are potentially bankrupt. I was recently with the main collaborator of the head of AXA, the main French society of insurance, the main insurance company.
Right.
Main French insurance. And he told me, you're right, beyond the scenes, we all know, all the currencies are bankrupt and all the banks are bankrupt. That's the situation. The rest is lie. It's a big lie.
So what does this mean for Sarkozy's presidential campaign, his re-election?
He's riding a tiger, and the tiger is biting him from all sides. So, and he's surrounded by sharks, and he's a nobody. So in that situation, his only asset is the socialists, because the socialists at this point are not really fighting for Glass-Steagall. They are sometimes talking about it, but they are not fighting for it, and they don't want a bankruptcy of the banks. They want Glass-Steagall without bankruptcy, so they don't want Glass-Steagall, in fact. They don't want an organized bankruptcy. At the same time, they are aligning with ecologists against nuclear energy. So at this point, they want the exit from nuclear energy, and Aubry, who is likely to be the socialist candidate for the presidential election, said that Merkel, despite she disagrees on social issues with her, is a very courageous woman, and she wants to imitate Merkel in her position with nuclear energy. So Hollande, the other candidate, said, we have to do like in Germany. He is more cute. He is saying in Germany, they cut from 20% to zero the portion of electricity coming from nuclear energy. We have to cut from 75 to 50. So 20% less, like the Germans did 20%. So it's insanity. The whole discussion is insane. Marine Le Pen, who pretends to be this extreme right-wing defender of the people for public sector and in favor of De Gaulle, she's praising De Gaulle now. His father was blaming De Gaulle all the time. She's praising De Gaulle. But she also came against nuclear energy, saying it's a very dangerous form of energy. We have it and we have to do with it, but we have to organize the exit. So there is not a single voice, a single political voice, except in a certain way Sarkozy. He doesn't know what it is, but he sees that as power. There is not a single political voice defending nuclear energy the way we do, as an expression of the potential creativity and the creativity of human beings. This nobody is on that. And everybody extrapolates instead of seeing that we are at a moment of history where you have to master a discontinuous change, and the past cannot be an example for the future, and the present is not deductible, and the future is not deductible from the present. So we have a situation where there should be this organized platform of human creativity to give to the future and to pay to the future the debt that we own to those in the past that make what we are today, that made what we are today. So we have to pay this debt to future generations and not to the banks. And that's a big issue now.
So Jacques, I think from what you've just described, both in terms of the economy and the nuclear question, that your candidacy is the only one that actually approaches these things on the level of principle, that you would support, you're supporting a Glass-Steagall reorganization of the French banking system and a continuation, not just of the existing French nuclear program, but actually the development, the funding of research for the next generation. Is that pretty much accurate?
Yes. It's a reactors of the fourth generation, the HTRs, but not only, the fast breeders also, and fusion. And others, in fact, have no conception of the way in which the universe changes itself. They don't see the action of the creative powers, the willfully creative powers of the human mind. They don't know what a human being is at this point. That's a big problem we have with the socialists. The socialists, I found a poster of the socialists in 1946 where they were calling for science is progress and it's for the good of human beings. Nuclear energy is our main asset. So this is what they were saying in 1946. So I'm opposing that to what they are doing now. And that is creating a lot of a shock in the Socialist Party. That's very funny, in the base and in certain elected officials who know that their leaders are opportunists and swines.
Now, Speaking of opportunism and swinishness, Sarkozy has been running a kind of anti-Muslim type campaign. You have the situation with the chaos in Africa, the breakdown and the still failure to develop the former French colonies in Africa. You have been on record. You visited Africa not that long ago. You're a supporter of the TransAqua project. To what extent are these issues in France today, the question of developing Africa, using French technology to, instead of build a wall around the country, actually develop the African continent?
There is very little of it. People know that if you don't develop Africa, there will be this coming of immigrants to escape from death in Africa. But nobody wants to do what has to be done for the development of Africa. They are saying, a lot of people, I met a prominent engineer, one of the best experts in the world on hydraulics, and he said nuclear energy is not for Africa. In Africa, it's much easier to bring to them solar energy and windmills. So this is what you are having, and eventually dams. So this is what you are having. You're having people who are not thinking of Africa as a point of development for the future, but seeing Africa as something you take care of to avoid to be in to have trouble coming from them. And that's the issue. In fact, all these racist or xenophobic rants against the Muslims its reason is that they want to hide under an ethnic issue the real social problems that are affecting France. So a lot of people see that, and they said, no, the question is not the question of even a clandestine immigration or the Muslims. The question is what socially the governments are doing. What are they doing to develop the economy, to create jobs? And
well,
let
me just pick that up, because we've seen in Spain the emergence of what they call the indignados. We're seeing something similar in Greece, that is, young people who are not anarchists, who are not nihilists, but are saying, we want a future. We demand a future. And I'm wondering if there's something similar emerging in France.
Sure, there is. There is in the Bastille. So they are saying, what they are saying is that at some point people were able to destroy the Bastille, so now we have to destroy the financial system and we have to destroy this unjust rule of the mega banks. So, but they have no real idea of what has to be done about it. So we are bringing our ideas to them. We are in a process of discussion with them in various places, in Spain, in a certain extent in Greece, and in Paris more actively. And they themselves are calling now for a separation of investment and speculative financial activities. So they don't yet quite understand what Glass-Steagall means as the cleaning of the Augeas stables. This they don't quite understand, but they understand that it's something needed to prevent the sharks to bite the people. So we have to go further, and we are trying to develop with them the concept of platform that LaRouche outlined, and what is really science. So we try to give to them a sense of what is discussed now between Sky and Lynn and others, which is a sense of organizing the minds of people a conflict, and people by themselves, if they are correctly organized, they see, or they tend to see, that there is a way to overcome this conflict from a higher standpoint. So we are bringing the higher standpoint into their minds and showing to them that the study of Glass-Steagall, the study of the New Bretton Woods, the study of the Eurasian land bridge can be for them a way to understand that human beings can change the environment, can change the biosphere, and are able to change the future. But they change the future only if they locate themselves in the future. So this is, I think, what's happening. And there is a moment of opportunity for us, at the same time, is a moment of risk. So this is taking place now. We cannot say that we are going to win, but we can say that we are more heard than we ever have been before in France, the same as in the United States.
Now, let me ask you just to extend this last thing you said a little further. One of the things that LaRouche talks about is the Glass-Steagall as a principle of the American Constitution, a unique concept of credit, and that credit, by its very nature, is about how you shape the future. And by doing that, you change the past and the present. Now, this concept of a principle of credit, I know that at times in France, including in modern France, there have been people who have had some conception of this. How do you see, is there a tradition of this in France, and how do you bring this into the political debate?
Yeah, there is. There was this law of 1945, which after the victory against the Nazis was voted to create the social and economic conditions where this would never come back. So this was a separation of credit banks, what they called here credit banks, deposit banks, and business banks. And the business banks were put apart, and so were the insurance companies. So this has existed. And people know it's not in the Constitution, but the preamble of the Constitution of October 1946 established principles which are coherent with the general welfare. They give a lot of social rights which are very similar to the Roosevelt speech of 1944. So it's very interesting because it creates a sense of America in the minds of the French. If you tell a Frenchman today that Glass-Steagall has to start from the United States, people sometimes get furious or they can't understand it. But if you explain this formally to them, the discussion leads to nowhere. If you tell them first, you should understand what is economics, that it's not money. It's something else that was in the principles of the Constitution in the United States and then in a certain way in the French Constitution. Second, you should understand that what is the oligarchical principle as a principle of destruction. And the principle of Glass-Steagall is the opposed principle, is a principle of the future, that you locate your identity in the future and not in the present or the past. And then third, you have to understand that in the United States as a nation was founded against the oligarchical principle, against that oligarchical principle. Then if you lead the situation in that sense, in that historical sense, then the discussion becomes much more fruitful because these people in France start to think in terms of a dynamic international process. And that's key for France. France never has been good except when it has been located its identity in a historical dynamic, in an international historical dynamic process.
So even when you have the president of France trying to promote a Franco-German alliance as something that's bigger, it's still constrained within that same problem. It's when you think about it in that broader context that you can get people to start thinking?
Yeah, and in a sense, what they call is to, there is a saying in France, it's when you feel the wind from America, but not what Obama and Wall Street mean. So you have to show them that the United States is not something as such. It's a fight. It's in the becoming. It's something that comes from a commitment to establish a true republic against the oligarchical principles prevailing in Europe, but it's a fight that's never finished. And
but we also have a record. We also have a record on that because the United States was very much helped by forces in France that were committed to defeating the British Empire.
Yeah, and France was victimized during the French Revolution by the same forces that ran a chaos and confusion operation in France, and also by the incapacity of some, like Lafayette, to face what the oligarchical principle is. And they like too much the ancien regime, as it is said. Mm-hmm. So we have what Lafayette failed in 1789, 1790, has to be taken back, and we have to succeed. So that's also the challenge linked to this question of the French-American relations.
Well, Jacques, we have just a little less than 5 minutes, and I'd like to ask you then, if, as Jeff identified at the beginning of the program, we now have in motion a new dynamic in which the continued presidency of Obama is tied to the bankruptcy, the wars, and if in fact we can get a Glass-Steagall and bring Obama down, what would be the first steps that would happen then in France?
Probably the French establishment, or part of the French establishment, or part of the French institutions, would push Sarkozy to do the same. And it will not come from political parties. It will come from what is known in France as a party of the administration, or the party of the state, which is something very specific to France, because you have this group of people which identify with the fate of the French state. So at this point, most of them have been bought or corrupt by the banking establishment. In a situation of crisis, something can happen very fast from there, because these people have a certain sense of reality. So some would be out of what's left of morality in them, which will be awakened. Others would be in the sense of reality, and not maybe for humanist reasons, but because they see the change in history, and they would take the train. So the point at this point in France is to give a sense of what Martin Luther King was leading in his days, and what LaRouche and you people are leading in the United States, an organized nonviolent fight. Because French people tend, and that was a mistake in the French Revolution, tend to forget that they are human beings, and instead they want to have revenge and jump to the throat of their enemies. And this is very destructive. It's very destructive because you lose the sense that you are organizing the other if you do that. So a point that Martin Luther King stresses in his famous political speech, why you have to love your enemies. You don't have to love their ideas. You reject their ideas. You fight against them. But you think that you can change people. And in France, this has to come in the minds of people. It's happening with these indignados who are rejecting the lefties, the ultra-left, because they think that the ultra-left are fascists painted in red. And they don't like that.
Yeah. So there, in your view, then, there is a real possibility for a Glass-Steagall, and that's what you're leading the fight for, that as Lyndon LaRouche's representative in France, as a presidential candidate, you're leading the fight for this Glass-Steagall.
Absolutely, and there are people who are responding at this point. I can say it because he said it publicly. The former French Prime Minister Michel Rocard, who is still, now he doubts about the euro, but he was strongly in favor of the euro because of his European commitment. But at this point, he's calling for Glass-Steagall throughout Europe, and he's doing his best. He's old, not so old as Lynn, but he's old. But he thinks that he can still do a few things, a few useful things. But these people have not a clear enough mind on the connection of various things, because they don't look from above. They look from inside the fight and not from above. So what I can bring in the campaign is a look from above to inspire people to have a sense of reality and a sense of what a human being can do to change reality, the principle of change.
Well, Jacques, thank you very much for joining us today. And people can go to your website in France, if you speak French. It's Solidarité et Progrès. Am I right?
In only one word?
Yes. And that's on the web. And thanks for joining us today, Jacques. And I would urge people to go to the LaRouchePact.com, where we have the statement from Lynn today on Sleepers Awake, which is an evaluation of the transformation that's occurring around the fight to remove Obama and bring back Glass-Steagall. So, Jacques, thank you very much. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.
Thank you very much to all of you.